prison ever built. Its location is top secret. And when they erase your identity, you cease to exist.
Who were you before you came in here?
I break out of prisons for a living.
The people who paid for you to be here want you here forever.
The only way to stay alive is to break out.
I'm gonna burn this place to the ground.
Let's do it.
Welcome to Podcast Action Hero, the show that are men who watch films of which they know little, to record podcasts of which they know less, for listeners of whom they know nothing at all.
Get to the chopper!
I want to ask you a bunch of questions.
Hey, Christmas tree!
And I want to have them answered immediately.
I'm not a pervert!
You son of a bitch!
Are very sensitive.
Get your ass to Mars.
I'm not shitting on you. Fuck you, asshole.
Hi, I'm Gavin.
I'm Jamie.
And this is the podcast where we basically talk about Arnold Schwarzenegger films for an hour. And in this episode, we are talking about 2013's Escape Plan. Jamie.
Hello.
You're not going to escape talking about this one.
No.
What is your history with this film?
Well, this is getting so tedious. We're more than halfway through, and I think for like 90% of these, I've got the same story. I watched it for this podcast, and before that, I had no inclination towards watching it at all.
I always like to take this opportunity to revisit and remind listeners, especially if this is the first episode they've listened to, that this podcast was your idea.
Well, you know, one of us has got to be the expert. If we both knew everything about them all, then what would be the point? I'm the little learner monkey. Is that a thing?
All monkeys are learners, maybe, to a point.
They've all got those little red L's on them, haven't they? Yeah.
That joke is not going to travel well.
Nope, but I'm going to stick it in anyway. What's your history with this film, Gav?
My history with this film is, as far as I recall, I watched it probably when it first hit streaming, and I'd seen it once, and so when we watched it this time, I couldn't remember all of it, and I don't want to spoil it for the end, but I'm pretty sure that the reason I couldn't remember most of it is because there wasn't much in it worth remembering.
Yeah, it really smacks of the early days of Netflix when they just had Jason Statham movies and random action stuff and like nothing that was above like a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, definitely.
This and House of Cards.
This film spawned 2 sequels, by the way.
Yes, with, I was going to say escalating budgets. That's the complete opposite. It very much highlights how little Sly Stallone is commanding for a lead role these days.
Yeah, it's wild.
Before I go into my patented thrilling synopsis, as it always is, this film had a budget, according to Wikipedia anyway, of between 54 and 70 million, which is quite a range, to be fair. The sequel had a budget of 20 billion.
20 billion with a B? Was that?
Did I say billion? 20 million. I have got a bit of a cold. So 20 million for that one. Escape Plan 3, or Escape Plan The Extractors, had a budget of 3.6 million.
I've not watched any of the sequels, but I can imagine that it's really all on screen as well. You know, every single penny.
Yeah, it's got Sylvester Stallone, Dave Bautista, and 50 Cent in it. And you'd think all three of those would cost more than that.
I'm sure there's a joke in there about 50%, about 50 cents. Costing more. I think maybe I'm getting a bit of a cold as well because I feel like my voice is not on point and my brain neither.
It's fine. I've heard people podcast with much worse. Okay, so the synopsis of Escape Plan. Sylvester Stallone is a guy called Ray Breslin who his job is to test maximum security prisons for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Is that an actual thing? I don't know. It sounds like he made him up. He's put on a job where he's sent to some like a black site, essentially, to test it for people who don't get trials or whatnot, who want to be disappeared. who governments want to be disappeared. And he has to break out of it, but immediately it goes awry and he's denied the opportunity to have his evacuation code recognised. The warden's a complete dick. And he teams up with Arnold Schwarzenegger to bust out. Turns out they're on a massive cargo ship kind of thing in the middle of the sea. And through a bunch of planning, they escape. The summary is really front-loaded. Because once it becomes, how do we get out of prison? Well, what more can you do? It's just, yeah, they break out of prison.
What I like about this kind of film is it's never going to be one of those where somebody, you know, you go around somebody's house, for example, and they say, do you want to watch Escape Plan? You're not going to then say, what's it about?
Yeah, it's like Horrible Bosses or Office Christmas Party or something. Oh, what's that?
Family Vacation. As we say in the UK, it very much does what it says on the tin. Really briefly, the Federal Bureau of Prisons is a real thing.
Yeah, okay.
Just Google searched it while you were doing your summary. And one of the, you know, sometimes when you bring up a search on Google, it shows the homepage of the website and then some of the pages within it that you can click on straight away in like a menu below it. The first option on the Google search results for Federal Bureau of Prisons website is find an inmate.
Okay. In like a dating sense?
That is immediately where my brain went. It's like... There was a website called like findamate.com or something, right? It's, or am I imagining that?
I'd be very shocked if there wasn't a website like that.
Yeah. I feel like I'm almost certain there was a dating website called Find a Mate or Mate Match or something like that.
It's not bad, really.
Find a
Mate. He just likes to cut cats open.
Well, this is it, right? Because some people will definitely be using Finding Inmate as a dating website. They'll be fine, because you have that where they write, even Charles Manson's got people writing, people writing to him, ask, you know, proposals of marriage and sending him gifts and all those kind of things. So, yeah.
Of course, popular man. Popular man.
Should we do it now? Should we do it live and find an inmate?
This podcast could take a turn into true crime.
Jamie, one of the options to search with is an FBI number. Give me some random numbers.
Okay. 5782.
578. Oh. That's weird. My phone just shut down.
They know.
I just got to go to somebody at the door.
Rendition.
Right. Yeah, so good summary. Yeah, it definitely is, you know, there's not really much to it.
Not really. In a lot of ways, it's a throwback. It's almost like a Sunday afternoon or Sunday evening kind of dad film. It's very much a dad film, to be honest. And, you know, escaping prisons is traditionally, you know, like Great Escape or Escape from Alcatraz kind of thing. And that whole Prison Break TV show.
Yeah.
There's apparently people are fascinated with how to break out of things. And if that's what they're after, I think the problem with this film is that it doesn't satisfy anyone who's kind of... Like, if you were watching it like an Ocean's 11 thing where it's all explained and then they do it, or maybe they subvert it a little bit or something like that. Here, it's like, I trust that Stallone knows what he's talking about, but it doesn't make sense to me.
The thing is, it's when he's coming up with solutions and the things that he knows about the prison boat during the escape, he's like... Because they mentioned, like, just really, one of these sort of like they wouldn't call it a MacGuffin, would they? But one of the plot pieces is that he's written a book.
Mm-hmm.
He's written a book that the warden of the ship, played by Jim Caviezel, he's like Brisbane's number one fan, right? He's absolutely him. He doesn't know at first that's who he is, but he's his number one fan. He's got it's like a prison manual, how to create the most secure prison possible. He's got that on his desk in his warden's office on this boat. And so the idea is that you've almost got, really, you know, taking a bird's eye view of this, this is Sylvester Stallone against himself.
Yeah.
Because he's not really against the warden, he's not against any of the prisoners in there. He's against himself because apparently this prison has been built specifically based on his expertise and his experience. But I think they go a little bit too far, to the point where there's even a part where they are trying to escape and he knows things about the CCTV camera setup on the boat. Mm-hmm. And he knows that if we do this with the cameras, then it will loop all the cameras, because apparently CCTV is on a closed loop, and if you can interact with one camera, that shuts all the cameras down, which I'm almost certain is not really what happens with CCTV. I think that's the point, right?
I think the thing is, they've taken his expertise in security to be expertise in everything, because apparently security encompasses the entire world. Like, he knows everything about everything, and he knows about, like, geography, about sea navigation. He knows all kind of mechanics and, like, chemistry and all this kind of weird stuff. And he's like, if he was a woman, there'd be a whole bunch of men who would be very, very angry with this film.
He does seem to know shit where it's like, why? Why does he know that? Because here's the thing. Mm-hmm. There's a part in the film when he first tries to escape and try and figure out, like, where the prison is. And he comes out through a hatch, and that's when he first finds out. And that's when we're first introduced to the idea that it's a boat. It's a boat in the middle of the fucking ocean. Mm-hmm. There is no escape. And it reminded me of Face Off, where they come out, they try escape, and they find out they're on an oil rig in the middle of the sea. And so I'm getting the events of the film mixed up in my head, but I feel like at that point, Stallone already knew that the prison was based on his concepts and his designs and all these kind of things. So why was it, when he came out of that hatch and saw that he was on a boat, why did he look surprised? Why wasn't he, I fucking knew it.
Was it not?
Surely that was part of his design, like, the best place for a prison, on a boat.
Maybe specifically, he's like, maybe he was so annoyed because when he got up, he's like, oh, I should have thought of this. Well, like, played. I mean, I'm pretty much going to die here, but well played. Because there's a moment where he talks about architects, and he says, like, they look at things differently, and he goes into this weird 3D blueprint view kind of thing. And he lists parts of the prison, and he calls a part of it Babylon. And I don't know whether that's like a standard thing in prisons. There's always a tower called Babylon.
Yeah.
But it's the first time he mentions it. It's never mentioned before. I assume we were supposed to just go, oh, he means that big tower there. Or did he design it and call it Babylon?
Yeah, good question. I feel like I've seen things before about prisons to say, like, almost like the ideal prison is like a hub and spoke model. You've got this one tower at the middle that can have this 360 degree view of all of the surroundings, and it's raised up, and, you know, you can have people up there with, like, rifles and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you've got, like, the satellite towers around, which you do see on a lot of prisons, you know, you've got the satellite towers around it, keeping an eye on the walls. Yeah. Whether it's always called Babylon, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't surprise me.
Okay, so when this film started, I don't know about you, but there was a point this is the first time, I think, when we've been watching a film that we've had to go back and watch a scene again. Because we were like, did they explain any of how that worked?
Yeah.
And it turns out they do actually later recap it, because it starts with him in prison where you're not supposed to know who he is. As far as we know, he's actually a prisoner. And it's showing him escaping from a regular maximum security prison.
Yeah.
His team turn up, part of his Breslin security team or whatever, and detonate a car bomb in the car park.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's explained exactly how they know exactly what time to do that. Oh, no, I think they do, because he's counting down. You know, he asks the guard the time. But there's no explanation as to how they know what time, you know, how they've communicated from the inside.
Yeah. When they come back to it, the whole counting down time thing is for him, for when he knows that the guard station is going to be unoccupied. How the people outside know this remains unclear to me. But continue.
Yeah. Okay, so that's one thing. The main thing for me, though, is in order to escape, he has to be sent to solitary. Mm-hmm. That's part of his plan. To get put in solitary, he stabs an inmate in, like, a yard fight, and, like, properly stabs him, like, really goes in on him. If you're there to test prisons, no matter who you're doing it for, I'm pretty sure that stabbing is enough to have someone go, well, then we're going to actually sentence you to prison. I mean, you probably escape, but you are genuinely supposed to be in prison now.
Yeah. If this was a real consultant's job, I can imagine that there would be some kind of contract and agreement with that particular prison or prison service or whatever company owns that particular prison, where if/when he escapes, and then potentially any damage he causes to the premises in the process of escaping would be, like, forgiven. You know, he's not going to be prosecuted, all those kind of things.
Yeah.
Whether that would, first of all, stretch as far as detonating a car bomb in the car park outside, which is, let's investigate the levels here, Jamie. Let's
Okay.
let's workshop this.
Right.
Damage to the car park is one thing. Mm-hmm. The risk of injury to people around, you know, obviously, she, you know, the his partner, the woman, she gets out of the car, there's nobody about, but they detonate the car. I'm still almost certain, I don't know very much about US law, and by not very much, I mean nothing, but I would imagine that probably detonating a car bomb is some kind of federal offence. So even if there an agreement with the prison that they don't mind if there's, again, damage and disruption, maybe it's federal prison, maybe that's how they get away with it. But absolutely to your point, there is no fucking way they're giving this guy a license to kill in the prison. Not that he kills the guy, but like, he might have done.
But I mean, he could have.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, but obviously, no, remember, he knows everything about everything, so he knew exactly where to stab someone to not kill them.
God, it's like, he's looking at the guy, and like in his mind, he's like an architect then, where he's like seeing this guy
the,
like...
the blueprints of the person.
He's like fucking Sherlock Holmes. Immediately like seeing like the position of all the arteries and the muscles and all these kind of things. And I think I said when I was watching this, when we were watching this together, it reminds me of this TV show that used to be on, it might have been back in the 90s or the early 2000s, and some listeners might recall this, where it was called John Doe. And it was this actor, Dominic Purcell, who was later in the Prison Break TV series as the guy who's in prison and he's getting broken out by his brother. But Dominic Purcell, I played this guy called John Doe, because he was a man who woke up on this like island just off the coast of the USA with no memory whatsoever of who he was. He wakes up there, he's naked, and he's like, he doesn't know what to do. No memory of who he is, what his name is, what his identity, doesn't know about his past, but he knows everything else somehow. He's like an expert on absolutely everything. He walks into a room, and then for some reason he knows how big that room should be, and so if the room is a little bit shorter than it should be, he's like, fake wall. And then one of the episodes, he gets into he's got no memory of like learning how to drive, but he gets into like an AC Cobra sports car, and all of a sudden he can drive it like fucking race car driver, I suppose. And this film was giving me those vibes. It's like, guy who for the most part comes across as very unassuming, but he just like knows everything. Mm. There's always a convenient piece of knowledge or experience he's got to get him out of a situation, even though the whole premise of the film is like, this guy who knows everything is now in a situation where he doesn't know everything, but he does.
Yeah, he still does. He still knows. He's like, I'm looking for the patterns. Like, and I think there's three things he said that he needed to escape that he normally looks for. I can't remember the other two, but I remember the line was, but damn if I didn't notice a pattern or something like that.
Yeah.
It's like about the guard's shifts changing or something like that, because they've got no idea what time it is, but he notices what the guards do, and one of them always taps his neck and one of them's got a bit of a limp or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like,
okay, how long have you been in there? Because they make a point after the first scene, which incidentally, after he's escaped that first prison, he's chased by so many police cars. You can maybe add wasting police time at least to the rap sheet there. Why not just sell them after you've got out? No, that was a test, rather than actually go on the run.
Risk it, because they all turn up with guns drawn, ready to shoot him, because he's escaped from maximum prison. I wonder what his cover story was. Like, what was the crime in his cover story? If it was like murder or something, and they've got like an escaped murderer.
Right, because it's maximum security. So it's not like...
How does he know that they're not going to turn up and just shoot him dead?
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for the white privilege of that situation. So after the first escape, he goes back to his office, which is quite swanky. You know, they're making a lot of money from this. And there's a receptionist, and he's like, are you new? And she was like, no, I've been here 5 months. And that's meant to indicate he was in that prison for 5 months, I think.
At least, yeah.
So that's the whole point of this whole thing, is that, like, it takes him time, but he will escape.
And I think they do make a reference around about that time of, you know, what he's sacrificed for this job. You know, he spent most of his life behind bars. Yeah.
It's the first prison warden says what kind of a man voluntarily spends his life in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
And as it turns out, it's a man whose family were killed, which is kind of a standard motivation for an action hero.
Is it weird that I've got no memory whatsoever of his family dying being a part of the film? Like, when was that said? Like, you just told me about that, and I'm like, did they?
I think it's used as a bit of, like, common ground between him and Arnold, who we haven't spoken about yet.
Hmm.
There's something to do with, like, there's a moment where Arnold says, I understand that I have a daughter. Other than that, I don't think it really matters. really. I guess maybe the screenwriter was like, but wouldn't a man like Stallone have a wife and kid? And we have to explain why he doesn't. I don't know.
Wouldn't it be a good addition to the film if the reason he is so dedicated to, you know, making prisons unescapable is because his family were killed by like an escaped convict or something like that?
Right. No, that was basically it. He used to be a prosecutor, didn't he?
I cannot remember.
Right, hang on. Let me get on Wikipedia here. There's a moment where he says, I used to be a prosecutor, and former prosecutor Ray Breslinger is driven by the murders of his wife and child by an escaped convict he has successfully prosecuted. So there you go, yeah. It makes sense.
Oh, well.
So it's like, one person escaped from a prison, I'll make sure no one can ever escape from a prison by constantly escaping from prisons.
So that really good idea I had for the film, it turns out that was the idea from the film. I just forgot or wasn't paying attention.
It sounded great in the moment.
Thanks, mate.
Should we probably talk about Arnold, considering this is an Arnold podcast?
Yeah, but I don't feel too bad about it, because we're about 30 minutes into recording, and it's about 30 minutes into the film before Arnold even appears in it, so...
That's true.
That's fine.
It's very true.
But yeah, let's talk about Arnold.
What's his name? What's his name as we understand it in the beginning? It's Emile Rottmeyer.
Hmm.
He describes himself as the fourth musketeer out of nowhere.
No, I don't think he does. He's talking about... Oh, well, is he? I don't know, because that isn't that when he's talking about...
Victor Mannheim.
Well, he picks up on Stallone's like fake name in the prison. I've just immediately blanked on it. Was it Porthos?
Oh, so right.
Who is one of the musketeers.
Got you.
And so, but the thing is, I thought that Porthos was one of the original three musketeers, and it was D'Artagnan that ended up being the fourth musketeer. So maybe that's what he's getting at, I don't know.
And Albert was the fifth musketeer, as we all know.
What?
Do you not remember the TV show? Albert the fifth musketeer.
No, I do not.
It was a cartoon in the early 90s.
I was thinking of D'Artagnan, and I was like, was that a character in D'Artagnan?
I would have loved some D'Artagnan cameos in this film.
So yeah, Arnold.
So Arnold. He's very much a supporting character. I mean, he's the second lead, really. It is to some degree a two-hander, but he's, you know, he'd get a nod for supporting actor if he was Oscar nominated for this. But like, it's weird that it's sold on it being the two of them.
Mm.
He's in it more than he's in stuff like the Iron Mask or whatever.
Mm.
So it's not like it was missold, but he's not really, it's not about him. Oh, well, it kind of is in the long run. Like, as far as the plot goes, it is about him entirely. Should we just spoil it so there's a twist?
Yeah, we spoil all these films. Why not?
Yeah, that's true.
Which is weird, because some of them seem like they can't be spoiled.
Right. this can't really be spoiled either. It doesn't really matter, because when he meets Emile Rottmeyer, he describes himself as a guy who works for or does security for Victor Mannheim, who's like a modern-day Robin Hood. You know, steals from the rich, gives to the poor. It turns out, obviously, pretty obviously, to be honest, that he is Victor Mannheim. And this whole job has been set up. It's posed as it's set up by the CIA to test this really strong prison.
Mm.
But it's actually his daughter, who was pretending to be from the CIA, who was trying to break him out via some kind of elaborate passing messages back and forth. I don't know how you do that. They do explain it, I think. There's a flaw in the plan for me, because when she's giving him the job at the beginning, she's saying, right, in order to test this prison properly, the rest of your team can't know where this location is. Is that a problem? And they're all like, yeah, it's a problem. And he's like, well, okay. And then he gets bundled into a van, and the plan goes awry before he even gets there, because there is a secret villain in this, well, not so secret villain. God, it's one of those that's got like about 15 different complicated, snaky twists in it, but like they're all so obvious and so boring.
Yeah.
There's no reason for her to not tell the team the location of this place, right? She's invested to the point she wants to break her dad out.
Yeah.
She's telling this one guy who she thinks can break him out. Where's the risk in telling the rest of his team?
Well, yeah, because it wasn't clear to me until... It felt like it was clear to me all the way through the film, because, like I say, she was positioned as a CIA agents, but then it turns out, if I recall correctly, then she wasn't. And so then it's a case of, well, how does she know then? Because she says, I can't tell you the location of this prison. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if, A, is that because the location of the prison today may not be the location of the prison tomorrow, for example? Is that what she's kind of hinting at there, maybe, possibly? But is it also the case that, well, she can't tell them what the location of the prison is because she doesn't know, because she isn't CIA? Like, how would she know the location of this prison? Like, did Schwarzenegger's character get a message out somehow of, like, where he was? Right. So that's not massively clear. And, of course, when they... Stallone's character, Breslin or whatever his name is, he gets bundled in the back of the van. He gets like proper abducted style.
Yeah.
They scan him for trackers and he's got a tracker in his arm and they sort of like, they cut it out of him and that's when he goes missing. And that's when
because
it all...
they know that there's a tracker because there's an inside man.
Because of the inside man. Because like you say, in terms of obvious, you know, twists and you know, red herrings and all that kind of stuff, you've got, why am I forgetting his name?
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah.
Vincent, I just came in for the afternoon, D'Onofrio.
So you've got, and he's one of those guys where you see his name in the credits and you're like, bad guy, it's him.
Yep, absolutely. But he's one of two bad guys, really. Like, he's the one who ultimately sets this plan in motion, but also doesn't really get a proper, he's not really in the film very much at all. Your main bad guy is old Pop Jim Caviezel. Who's playing it like Gary Oldman in Leon, you know, of like Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet or something. He's going like way over the top theatrical. It does not match the tone of this film at all.
No. He also can't decide what his tone is. He can't decide what his accent is. He's like his... like at some points he sounds like Christopher Walken. Some points...
He really does, doesn't he?
Or like some points he even sounds like Jordan Peterson.
Oh.
The way he's talking, like just his mannerisms and his intonations and those kind of things. There's various points where I almost expect him that he's going to start talking about fucking lobsters and how like prisoners are easy to control because they're like lobsters and lobsters have got no shoulders and lobsters will change them. In fact, I don't know. But
and of course, the reason that like everyone was in prison is because like something to do with women taking their agency away.
And they don't, not teaching RE in schools or whatever sort of bullshit is. he very much seems like a man who lives on a boat and only has, like, Breitbart to keep himself entertained or, like, the Daily Wire.
Yeah.
He's that guy.
Or, I guess, Vinnie Jones to keep him company as well. Vinnie Jones, who's kind of, he's like his right-hand man, but he's like the Starscream to his Megatron. He's like... absolutely treated like shit the entire time.
Not everything's about Transformers, Jamie.
Sorry.
What's weird is, like I say, he's his right-hand man, but the idea is that this... and here, oh, God, here's the thing. What's maddeningly frustrating is the idea is this prison is supposed to be this top-notch, state-of-the-art security prison, but it's like the tale as old as time where they invest as much as possible in these systems and the environment, and then they populate it with dickheads. Like, the staff are just still going for these massively underpaid, undertrained people who should probably be in the prison themselves. And it's like, you know, it's Vinnie Jones doing his Vinnie Jones thing, and it's like, surely if this guy is, I'm guessing, the most senior, I don't know, captain of the guard, he should be
He's the only one without a mask on.
He's the only one without a mask on. Well, that's probably Vinnie Jones being like, I want my money, bitch. I want my name over the fucking title. And I'm not interested in brushing my teeth with dog shit. This is the most senior guard in the place, and he's the worst behaved. He's like, he should be on the other side of things as well.
Yeah. His first scene, they basically say, you've lost a prisoner, which I'm pretty sure means he's died. And like, he gets his entire month's wages docked because that was the value of the prisoner.
Well, that's one of the scenes between when Stallone gets stuffed in the van and when he wakes up in the prison. He's sort of like going in and out of consciousness when he's in like a helicopter or a plane or something.
Oh,
and
that's the guy, right?
And he just sees like Vinnie Jones just murdering one of the other prisoners and dumping him out of the helicopter. And that's why that happens. Who are the writers of this? Like, this is such a confused tone. It started making me think that, you know, surely this is one of these scripts where it's been through loads of different writers and script doctors. And so I've looked it up.
Okay.
And one of the writers, a chap called Miles Chapman, Didn't mean to do that. A chap called Miles Chapman. As well as Escape Plan, he's also written Escape Plan 2 and Escape Plan 3. He's also the writer on something called Cybergeddon and the long-awaited Roadhouse 2 Last Call.
Oh, no.
So, yeah.
So his career's going great.
Absolutely.
And I'm just looking at the director as well. The only thing I've seen of his is that 1408, which is that weird trippy...
Sam Jackson, John Cusack, Stephen King.
Yeah. Yeah, stuck in a hotel room that keeps changing and whatever, which was fine. It feels like they've probably just spent all the money on the wrong things in this. Like, imagine if someone like Edgar Wright had directed it, or Michael Bay even. You know, Michael Bay might have made the same film, but made it look interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Would have made it absolutely bonkers. So yeah, I don't, maybe a bit of a walking backwards in terms of the format of the show, but yeah, I just wanted to have a look at that. Who wrote it? Was it loads of people? No, it was two people. One of them has some, as best I can tell, reasonable writing credits.
Oh, really?
The other one, a load of shit.
Guess which one got most of the work?
Do you know what to me was the most relatable part of this film?
Tell me.
I think it's the part where Jim Caviezel's character, when he first finds out that it is this Bresbin guy, that Stallone is who he is, and it's like his biggest fan, and he knows that he's trying to escape from the prison, and that he's the guy who, if anybody can escape, it's him. And then Jim Caviezel, I guess, is kind of conflicted, which might explain some of his, you know, his character's behaviour. Because on the one hand, it's like his hero, in a way. He's like his biggest fan. And I think he says something
to that effect. Never meet your heroes.
Right. But on the other hand, he's like a huge threat, because if he does escape from this prison, then that's really bad for the warden. And so he basically starts torturing him, and he stops him, won't let him sleep, keeps him tired, keeps him exhausted. And there's points where, like, Stallone is sort of, like, staggering around the place, and he can barely pay attention, and Schwarzenegger keeps trying to talk to him. And I was watching this part, and I'm just thinking, I too know what it's like to be tired, Mr. Stallone. I absolutely, like, this is the most represented I've ever felt in a film, is just seeing him staggering around fucking exhausted from, I don't know, sleep deprivation.
And I'll be honest, there's a moment where, as a punishment, as a further punishment for misbehaviour, you get put in a thing that they called the box, which is just bright lights and really soaring heat.
What's in the box?
It's Arnold Schwarzenegger! But, like... But it was really cold while we were watching it in my room, and I was like, you know what? Put me there. Put me in, coach.
Yeah, because they've got them under these like big heat lamps, and I'm looking at it thinking, oh, that's like one of those sad lamps. You know, like this time of year, point of recording.
Can you imagine?
We're in November. It's getting dark at like 5 p.m. And I'm like, yeah, just put me under the big, bright heat lamp and get my body producing some vitamin D.
You're not seeing the sun at all when you're under, well, not underground, under the deck. You're like below deck. The actual prison, because like there's the open area, which has got like Babylon and all the whatever in it. But their actual cells kind of look like modern workspaces.
Yeah.
You know, like an office set up that Google would have in a warehouse or something like that, where it's just like loads of little shipping containers made of glass kind of thing, and looks quite nice, to be quite honest.
You can imagine that when that place was first built, and then potentially, you know, whether it was the warden being shown around it, like, it's been built, the designer is, like, showing around going, like, amazing open-plan living, and a real community feeling in this area. You can literally see your neighbours just across the way. Look, one of them's taking a shit right now.
Right, again, we've still not really talked about Arnold.
Well, there's not that much to talk about. He's a character in it who has two identities. One of them is a German name, and the other one is a German name. And it's like, and it's supposed to be a fucking surprise at the end when he says, actually, I'm Mannheim. And it's like, what? The one sort of Germanic character with the Germanic name is also the other character with a Germanic name? Holy shit.
And actually, it would have probably helped with the escape plan if he'd admitted this earlier, because the entire film, Breslin is trusting Rottmeyer.
Yeah.
He's trusting him just based on the fact that he was the first guy to come and have a conversation with him. And like, they're like best buds, and they're sharing all this info about how to escape, and like, this whole plan comes together between, like, from conversations between those two. There is no reason that Stallone should be trusting Arnold in this situation. And if he said, oh, by the way, I'm actually Mannheim, that might have actually been like enough of a, oh, well then, it's probably worth helping.
Or also to maybe come up to him and say, like, I guess there is a reveal at some point, but I don't think it's straight away, for Schwarzenegger as Rottmeier to come up to Stallone and say, I know exactly who you are, and I know what you do, and I know that you break out of prisons. I've arranged for you to be here to break me out of prison.
The reason that they don't say this is entirely because they wanted that scene at the end of the film where they explain it and we go, oh.
Yeah.
In terms of actual practical, what would really need to happen for them to logically get out of there, he should have said it up front.
Yeah, because the trust for that relationship, the trust necessary for Stallone's character, Breslin, to be willing to openly share the fact that he can create a sextant to navigate the stars on a boat in the ocean from a pair of glasses and a biro pen.
Oh, my God.
Magic, again, he magic knows everything. Slide. He knows everything. How the fuck does he know how to make a sextant?
It was quite funny because, like, when he was building that, my first thought went to the ET phone home device, and you said sextant, and then immediately they went, oh, it's a sextant. I mean, I know you've seen it before, but it's not like the first thing that comes to your mind would have been, oh, I remember the sextant bit.
Yeah, I couldn't remember it. I had no memory of that whatsoever, but I was like, hey, maybe this is it, because that's one of those things where I'm like, how the fuck do I know what a sextant looks like? I don't know about boats.
Subconsciously, you know it because of Escape Plan.
Maybe that's it, yeah.
Okay, there's two firsts, as far as I'm aware, regarding Arnold in this film. One, it's the first time there's an actual fist fight between him and Stallone on camera, as far as I know. Unless there was an altercation in the Expendables, but I don't think so.
No, I don't think so.
And two, he speaks German for a good 5 minutes. As he's faking being angry and religious.
Yeah, well,
Jim Caviezel being the devil, which is quite funny, because Jim Caviezel is about the hardcorest of all hardcore Christians.
He's faking having like a nervous breakdown, like the box has broken him. And he started talking German.
Yeah, it's not very convincing. But like... Yeah, I've never heard him speak German before, I don't think.
Well, I feel like it's Kindergarten Cop where he speaks a little bit of German, but it's only like a couple of lines or something like that. I feel like it's when his partner's being sick out of the car, and when he's carrying her back to the car, he's talking to her in German somehow.
Oh, really?
But yeah, I think maybe there's a couple of films where he says a little bit. But I feel like, as well, I remember reading at one point that he, for a long, long time, refused to speak German in any of his films or anything like that, because... he wanted to focus so much on being like accepted by a US audience that he didn't want to be speaking a foreign language, because he's already contending with the fact that he's got this really strong Austrian accent.
Yokel.
Well, this, yeah, I mean, apparently, because, you know, I think we talked way back in, which episode was it where we were talking about why he didn't do his, I think it was it for Terminator, I think, maybe?
Maybe.
Why he didn't do the voiceover for the Austrian version of the Terminator is because what we read or what we hear is this perhaps really intimidating accent in Austria is actually more of a rural hillbilly accent as well.
Slightly less intimidating. He's like, all right, my lover, I'll be back. This film kept on surprising us with, like, people who are in it.
Yeah, but not like a, oh, they're in it, but like a, what the fuck are they doing in it?
Yeah, it's like I haven't thought about them in years. First of all, the first one I think is 50 Cent, who I'd say is wasted in this film because he's not in it much, but he's not really. Because when I saw him, I was like, oh no.
But he is wearing glasses, so you know he's playing against type.
Yes, of course, he's Arnold in Junior. Yeah, there's also a scene where he's building some security. This is another example of Stallone being magic. He's on his computer at his desk, and he's got these two 3D models of a cube that's like split into millions of other little cubes. It's supposed to represent some kind of security unbreakable code or something. And Stallone just comes along and presses like enter and it breaks it, and he's like, you've not done well enough there. It's like, come on, you've been away for 5 months and you come back and you hit one key and you've destroyed like 5 months of work. But yeah, 50 Cent's in it. Then Vincent D'Onofrio shows up and you're like, oh, okay, cool, Vincent D'Onofrio. Then you've got Jim Caviezel, you've got Vinnie Jones, you've got Arnold, which we already knew. Sam Neill's in this film, and he's probably, I reckon he was on set about as long as Vincent D'Onofrio. Like, he just happened to be passing on the lot or something, and they were like, Have you got 10 minutes? Here's a lab coat. Can you just pretend to be a doctor for 10 minutes, please?
He's like, all right, mate, now I just want to get back to my vineyard and make my wine. I think you'll find that is the best Austrian accent. Fucking hell. I don't know.
We're doing really well here, mate.
I was going to say Australian accent, but he's not even Australian. He's a Kiwi.
Yeah.
This is the point where I stopped making notes.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I feel like in various episodes in the past, I've talked about points where I stopped making notes. And I think what I feel I've identified this far into the show is that there's, broadly speaking, two reasons I stopped making notes. One of them, and I think I mentioned this primarily with the recent Terminator Dark Fate episode, mm-hmm. was like there comes a point where Arnold comes into it as the character Carl. And it's not long after that really the action starts. And it's like, well, how much notes can you write about action? Because now I'm just watching the film.
That's true.
And the other one is a point where I'm just like, I'm fucking bored. There's nothing for me to keep writing notes about. And so I will say, just to manage your expectations, is that from this point on, I've got no notes about what happened in the film. So we're going to have to go as best we can off my Swiss cheese memory.
Well, honestly, my notes are, I did keep making notes, but they're more general and the stuff like, this had better be going somewhere. It feels like the end of Act 2, but we're only an hour in. There's one note I made here. It's about a character that we haven't talked about yet called Javed.
Oh,
who
yeah,
I think
yeah.
is one of the guys who's in the first Iron Man, I think, who's in the cave. And he is initially a bit of an antagonist. He's like one of the guys who neither Sly or Arnie get on with. But then because of that, they use him as part of the plan. And his role is basically to ask if he can do open-air prayers at midnight. Because there's a whole group of people who are like, I guess, the Muslim contingent or whatever, and he's part of that. So he has to, in return for giving information to Jim Caviezel, which I'm pretty sure he's all made up, right? Or maybe like gives him little bits of uninteresting information.
Yeah, they give him information that he can give to Jim Caviezel that is like just convincing enough to be true.
So he gets to go out in the open air, and as a result, he gets to see the stars and uses the sextant to kind of determine where they are. This plan does involve more people than just the two of them. Javed ends up obviously dying because he's not important enough to live. He's got to have a very dramatic sacrifice kind of death.
Yeah, when you've got three people escaping, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, and Asian guy, one of them's got to go.
Yeah, you kind of see how that's going to go. They do give him a bit of a Boromir from Lord of the Rings death, though, where he just gets like bullet after bullet after bullet and then keeps getting back up and going more.
Willem Dafoe in Platoon.
Oh, you know what? I've never seen it.
Welcome to Dafoe Cast Action Hero, where we're going to watch every Willem Dafoe film.
Jesus, that'll be, I'll be 50 by the time that's finished. Yeah, but also Javed, does he just know how to use a sextant?
Well, I imagine there's a scene on the cutting room floor where he's shown how to use it because he knows how to like wear.
By magic Sly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, can you imagine like if Stallone's character created the sextant and then this Jav is like, how do you use it? He's like, I don't fucking know. I was hoping you would.
I've just been building these ever since I saw the instructions on the back of a cereal packet when I was a kid. I did make the other note that Sly escaped by getting flushed out of down the bog.
He is shit out the bottom of the boat.
Yeah. The last part is kind of, I mean, it's the action part. It's a bit more thrilling, I guess. But it is just the three of them, and then eventually the two of them when Javed's killed, getting to a helicopter that's been called in by an email from Sam Neill, right? He's sent a message to people to come and pick him up. And it turns out it's Mannheim's people, including his daughter. And at the end, you've got like an evacuation, get to the chopper, obviously. And it's the first of two films in a row where Arnold Schwarzenegger is on a helicopter firing a machine gun. It's literally how the Expendables 3 ends, isn't it?
Yeah, essentially. The thing about this film as well is, does it fall between Expendables 1 and Expendables 2 in terms of when those two are
I think
made?
It's between 2 and 3.
Is it 2 and 3? I can just imagine that like this film got made where they're like, look, we've got these two guys available. Why don't we just tack another film on to the end of like Expendables 2, for example? And it's just like shot at the same time. It feels like that kind of thing.
Kind of does.
I don't want to like tread all ground, but it goes back to something you mentioned earlier about this being like a film for dads.
Yeah.
But I'm sure we've said that it's not like a few of his films. It's just a film for dads. And it definitely reminds me of the sort of film when I was a kid that my dad would go to like the video shop and I'm like, oh, I hope he gets something good. And he'd come back with some like straight to fucking video Van Damme film or something like that. And it's mm-hmm. like...
Cyborg.
This is definitely... It had those sort of vibes with it. Yeah, the fact that it ties in with things like The Expendables is... That's it. It is sort of throwing back in the same way Expendables was to, like, here's these two guys with these big action stars who, you know, you want to see doing the thing again. You want to see them throwing down for the first time, like fighting each other. Mm-hmm. How great would that be? And then it's like 30 seconds and not much happens.
Well, because at the end of the day, it's two guys who are like 65 at the time. They've passed the point where it would have been interesting to watch them having a fight.
But they don't even like lean into the humour of two old guys fighting either. So it's neither thrilling watching these two guys fight, nor is it humorous watching these two guys right. fight and then afterwards being like, oh, my back.
Because there's absolutely no mention at all throughout the film of the fact that they're in the 60s no. and it's quite a challenge for them. Because like Stallone's not meant to be some, you know, super built, tough fighter guy. I mean, he is, obviously, because he's everything he needs to be in this film. And neither, you know, Arnold's, there's no section where it shows you him, like, you know, ripped or, like, showing him doing something like involving, like, his core strength or whatever.
He doesn't wake up in the morning and do three crunches like he does in junior, and that justifies his bodybuilder physique. Right.
They're just two guys who have got reputations.
Hmm.
I mean, maybe the fight thing was underplayed because they're not meant to be particularly physical. They're just two guys. They're just normal men.
Yeah.
And as it turns out, they are just innocent men.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Victor Mannheim is innocent in terms of, I think, do they imply that he just like steals from corporations and gives to people kind of thing? It's like a victimless crime as far as the public's concerned, but governments hate him.
Maybe. He's like a crypto bro. Well, to be fair, crypto bros are the opposite, right? They're stealing.
Crypto bros do not. Yeah, I was going to say.
They're stealing from poor people and keeping it for themselves.
Maybe Mannheim's entire crime was just like he exposed NFTs or something like that.
Yeah.
Do you remember there was a film around the same time? And I think I've got the two mixed up in my mind. So I was expecting this to be a sci-fi film.
Okay.
And it's kind of got the trappings of a sci-fi film in a lot of ways. It reminded me a little bit of there's one of the original Planet of the Apes films where it's set like in a prison. It's pretty good. It's better than this. And it cost about £6 as well. But there's certainly sci-fi trappings on this because like the set design is kind of sci-fi to some degree. The bad guys are all dressed like something from like THX-1138 or something like that.
Right.
They've got like sci-fi looking armor and obviously, you know, the black masks. But there was a film that came out around the same time with Guy Pearce where he was on a prison in space.
Lockout,
right. And I'm sure that's also utter garbage. But that's what I've had in my head as what this was. So I thought this was set in space, and it was slightly underwhelming when I found out it was actually at sea.
Well, a couple of things to say about Lockout.
Okay.
Number one, I think it's a better film than Escape Plan. I think it's number one, it's more fun.
Okay.
Number two, Guy Pearce is a way more interesting protagonist than Stallone, or even, you know, as a sporting actor, as Schwarzenegger. So the two team in Lockout is Guy Pearce and Maggie Grace, I think her name is. But the thing about Lockout is that it's a ripoff of Escape from New York.
Oh, really?
And actually, John Carpenter sued. I'm not sure if he sued Luc Besson as the producer or certainly sued the studios. Took him to court because of the similarities where, so in Escape from New York, you've got Snake Plissken, who's this ex-convict who's given this opportunity for freedom if he goes into the secure prison in Escape from New York to rescue the president. In Lockout, it's this ex sort of military guy, same deal, who's a convict and is given the opportunity for his own freedom if he goes into secure prison, in this case to rescue the president's daughter.
Oh my god, that's the plot of every 80s arcade game.
Right, so I believe that John Carpenter made a little bit of cash off the back of Lockout because it's just a blatant and I don't think you know, whether it's Luc Besson or the studio even tried defending it. They were just like...
just like, fair dues.
Yeah.
You got us.
Red-handed. So, yeah.
Maybe they looked at, like, Escape from LA and went, well, someone's already ripped it off and then didn't notice it was also a John Carpenter.
But the thing is, what's weird is there was talk years and years ago about a third Escape film called Escape from Earth. So Escape from New York, Escape from LA, Escape from Earth. Mm-hmm. And so, like, Lockout could feasibly have been, you know, like the third script flying around and then being adapted that
wasn't
way.
Ghosts of Mars what that turned into?
Maybe, yeah. I think you've got a point.
I think Ghosts of Mars was meant to be Escape from Mars or something like that.
But Lockout, better than that film too.
Well, okay. Maybe I need to watch it.
Give it a look. It's not great, but it's a fun yarn.
And that's what I wanted from this.
Yeah. Yeah, let's close the fucking circle on that side of things. That that was not this, and it's unfortunate that I think we've maybe done this once or twice before where we've struggled to talk about a particular film in this series. And we know we're struggling when we start talking about another better film. Especially when it's technically not even a good film. It's just a better bad film.
To be fair, the concept, pretty good. It's kind of, it's almost like a Hitchcockian kind of concept. A guy who's amazing at designing and escaping prisons is put into a position where he can't escape from the one he designed.
Yeah, it's a solid concept.
It's just every choice they make is the least interesting version.
It's clearly this thing that so many people have been waiting for basically decades. Let's get these two guys, these longtime rivals, who were just like setting each other up in the 80s. You know, like the stories of Schwarzenegger trying to put like the word out that he's interested in going for Stop on My Mama Will Shoot, I think it was. Because he then knew that Stallone would try and steal it from him. And he's like, I was never going to make that fucking film. And you know, in Commando, which we've obviously yet to talk about, where he's fighting, I keep wanting to call him Mac, but because I'm forgetting the actor's name immediately.
Oh, Bill Duke.
Bill Duke, that's it. And he's saying, you know, I'm a Green Beret. And he's like, I eat Green Berets for breakfast. And it's because Rambo is a Green Beret. And it's so you've got this like this rivalry for decades, for decades, for decades. And then it's like, finally, they're in a film together. And you know for a fact that I never saw the trailer for this, at least I don't remember seeing the trailer for this, but you know they would have put that fight between them in the trailer, and it's like, finally! And it reminds me of like fucking Batman Dawn of Justice or whatever it is, where you've got Batman and Superman fighting, and it's like, it's the Dark Knight bit, it's the Dark Knight Rises bit, it's Dark Knight Returns, I should say. They're going to fight, and then it's over in like less than 5 minutes, and you're like, ah. And it's the same thing. It's like this build-up for decades, and it's this like 30-second fight where it's over really quickly, and
And it's meant to be pretend anyway, so they're not even trying.
Yeah. In another world, there is this really interesting film. And again, maybe if it was made back in the 80s or something, where you've got this really interesting concept of it's a prison break movie, but it's a prison break movie from an unbreakable, outable prison.
That's a good word.
From the guy who designed the prison, and it's Stallone and Schwarzenegger. And they've got to, like, get along and get out. And somewhere in here, in another world, there is a version of this film where it's, like, really, really good. Mm-hmm. It's like all the ingredients being there, but the cake doesn't rise.
Yep. And I think part of that is that it came in an era, the wrong era. I mean, not just the 80s. I mean, if it come out, say, late 90s, early 2000s or something like that, or, like, probably during the time when Schwarzenegger was governor. Because action films were in a different place then. And maybe it's a post-9/11 thing where everything got very dour and everything's grey and everyone's serious or like a bit too angry. You know, there's no fun anymore in action movies. They've all got to be of a certain mould. And you can have fun, but it's like Marvel fun, you know. This could have been the action movie version of Heat. Where we've been waiting for that De Niro Pacino conversation all those years, but instead it's like the action movie version of Righteous Kill, where De Niro and Pacino are together at last and no one gives a shit.
So shall we rate this thing?
Yeah, let's.
Okay, so for first time listeners, when we rate this film, so we do it on the basis of a binary rating system
with nuance.
Sexy. where we basically say, if we think that you should watch this film, now that we've thoroughly spoiled it for you, we will say, do it now. And if we think that you should not watch this film because it's a piece of shit, we will say, put the cookie down. So, Jamie, for 2013's long-awaited moment-in-time escape plan, is it do it now or is it put the cookie down?
It's to put the cookie down. There's just nothing there. Maybe it's just my taste. I'm sure there's a whole bunch of people who watch this and they're intrigued by the what passes for plot twists and stuff. It feels it's almost like an NCIS movie or something like that. It's like,
yeah,
you could have it on in the background and maybe listen along, and you wouldn't necessarily have to watch it to follow it. You want more than that from a movie, for one thing, to actually imagine paying to go to see this. But also, you know, it should, like we say, it should have been a big event. It should have been, I don't remember any publicity for this saying Schwarzenegger and Stallone together at last or anything like that. Maybe the Expendables took the edge off that a little bit. But this could have been something more, and I don't know who's at fault. It just feels pedestrian and every opportunity squandered. To me, the whole thing just feels grey. Everything's grey in it. There's not even any interesting parts of the colour palette, and even Jim Caviezel doing his acting from every corner of the globe doesn't do anything to put some colour into it. Maybe, I don't know, Vinnie Jones's death was quite funny. But yeah, I mean, like, I can't think of much more to say than we haven't already said. We've pretty much made our feelings quite clear. It's put the cookie down for me. And I can tell that things are going to remain quite consistent in that regard for you.
Yeah, I'm going to say put the cookie down. Put it in a box. Put it in a box on a boat. In a box on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, just off the coast of Morocco, I'm going to say. And and then just to be safe, fucking sink the boat. Shit the cookie out of the bottom of the boat. I'm being overly harsh to it. It's not that. I'm going to say put the cookie down, but it's not that bad. It's just, maybe I've used this way to express how I feel about a film, but it's like a warm glass of water. You know, it's something where it's not bad, but there's not really a point where I want a warm glass of water. You know, and a warm glass of water on a hot summer's day, or a warm glass of water on a cold winter's day. It's like, it's not good for anything. It's not satisfying in any kind of context. That's the thing. It's like, it's not bad. It's just tepid. Never really, the stakes never feel that high. Because again, he knows everything. He's in an unescapable, outable boat, but he is the only escapable, outable guy in the world. So, it's a new word. So yeah, that's it. It's just like, it's, you know, no stakes. So for that reason, I'm going to say it's not a long film. I think
it is.
Is it?
It's too long. It's 2 hours.
All right. So but yeah, what I'm going to say is that if maybe it's one of those things you can have on in the background. Going back to what you were talking about when we were talking about it being like a dad film, and you were likening it to, like, it's in the same vein, but nowhere near the same quality of course, The Great Escape and Escape from Alcatraz. It's got the potential of it being like, you know, an Easter Sunday afternoon film where it's just on, you're tired, you're full of food, you're not paying attention, it's just there. That, for me, that's where this is going to sit. It's not a Saturday night film where it's like, get the popcorn, get yourself a drink, settle in to be entertained, because it's just not going to be that. So yeah, it's put the cookie down, there's better things to do with your time. So with the ratings out the way, I suppose we should find out what we're going to be watching and talking about next time.
Let's spin the wheel of pain.
So the film that we are going to be watching and talking about next time is Terminator 2 Judgment Day.
I feel like that's the elephant in the room for this last half of the podcast.
Uh-huh.
I'm surprised it's taken so long to get to this one.
But yeah.
Yeah, this is definitely, like, of all the ones that we've got left, this is the biggie.
Mm-hmm. It's all downhill from here.
I don't know. We've still got quite a lot of good ones, I reckon. Well, yeah.
You've seen it?
I've seen it with you, mate. You know it. We watched it in 3D, didn't we, in the Odeon?
Oh, God, yeah. We did. That was for the, what was it, the 25th anniversary or something like that would have been? Maybe the 30th?
Yeah, probably. 2016?
Yeah,
2016 would have been right.
Ah, memories, eh?
I suspect in the next episode I'm going to be saying things like dipshit a lot.
Your foster parents are kind of dicks, huh?
Easy money.
I thought he told the kids to get rid of that fucking mutt.
We're not going to struggle for episode titles for this one.
Nope, not at all. Well, I'm really excited for that one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and it's a long one, so we better make sure we get comfortable for watching it.
Is it? How long is it?
2.5 hours.
Never. Yeah. Is it really?
2 hours 17.
I'm going to have to plug my laptop in while I'm doing that then, because my battery will not make it.
That brings us to the end of this episode. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on The Social, singular. We are on Instagram at PodActionHero.
And I guess Letterboxd is kind of social media, so we're also a Pod Action Hero there. And whichever of the podcast players is still around, they're all changing. RIP Stitcher, RIP Google Podcasts. If you'd like to give us a rating and a review, if that's something you can do on your podcast app of choice, then I will put you in a box and I'll send you out to sea. But, crucially, I will bring you back and we'll have a nice roast dinner.
Excellent.
I'm a nice guy.
Well, in that case then, thank you for everybody listening, and we will speak to you and see you again next time.
Bye.